This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. This month, Immigration and Customs Enforcement sent $122,515 to the town of Carroll. The payment follows Carroll's decision to be part of the Department of Homeland Security's Task Force model, also known as the 287G program. Their participation means its four full-time police officers are committed to assisting ICE in federal immigration enforcement. They did just that in December when they detained seven people in Twin Mountain for ICE. To tell us more, I'm joined now by reporter Sammy Sussman over Zoom. His recent article in Wired broke the news about Carroll's payment from ICE. Thanks for being here, Sammy.
Yeah, nice to be with you.
Well, at their town meeting this month, Carroll voters were tied over whether to recommend the police department withdraw from their task force agreement with ICE. Now, in New Hampshire, towns can't prohibit police from working with federal immigration authorities, so the vote would only be a recommendation anyway. But what does Carroll's task force agreement with ICE entail?
Sure. So the task force model basically allows a department to designate specific officers, or in this case, the entire department, all the way up to the chief, to work with ICE in a variety of different capacities. So both detaining people, transporting people, and in return, ICE will pay salaries for that time. They'll pay some rewards based on how effective an agency is in detaining specific people. And they'll engage in more, I guess I would say, robust and kind of proactive collaboration than might otherwise be the case.
So what kind of incentives has ICE offered to Carroll and other local police departments to join this program?
Sure. So up until September of last year, ICE was offering $100,000 to every department that signed one of these agreements that they could use for a new vehicle or other equipment. And then they were also offering $7,500 for each officer that decided to join the program in each department. And that those $7,500 could also be used for equipment, for, you know, computers, vehicle purchases, something of that nature. Then in October, they kind of changed how that agreement works, and they added a financial component even after the agreement is reached, which is that they would cover an officer's annual salary and a quarter of that salary in overtime costs, only regarding work that these officers are doing for ICE, but that ICE is willing to pay up to the annual salary and up to 25% of that in overtime, along with this program where they look at each officer's their quarterly success in identifying specific undocumented people that ICE wants to have detained, I guess, or transported. It's a little unclear, but the agreement says that officers will receive between $500 and $1,000 each based on their quarterly success rate. They have these brackets of like 100% success to 91%, 90% to 81%. You get the idea. And there's a breakdown in cash rewards for each officer between $500 and $1,000.
So these are some significant numbers for a small police department, to be sure. Carroll Police Lieutenant Ann McMillan told NHPR that this $122,000 ICE payment is earmarked for new equipment for the department. He also said he's only requested some $945 for the department's work in that detaining those seven people back in December. Are you aware of other payments that have been made to police departments that are working with ICE, whether in New Hampshire or elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, I found out about Carroll when I was looking at a number of departments around the country. Carroll, I believe, is one of the first departments, at least, that has provided records of payments to reporters, to be clear. You know, I filed a number of records requests as reporters do around the country, and I didn't find many other records of significant payments in the way that I saw them in Carroll. That's not to say that that money isn't flowing. That's not to say that there are not agreements where money will flow from ICE to a lot of municipalities and counties around the country. But I believe that they're one of the first departments to actually see that money come through. There's a separate process that they have to undertake. They have to reach a service agreement with ICE and effectively become a contractor to get paid, right? Like there's a separate system to allow the federal government to disperse funds. And so part of the records that I obtained that were not included in the article are just the fact that Carroll successfully completed that program and they're now registered to receive money from the federal government. So I would assume that a lot of other municipalities are somewhere in that process, but haven't reached the point where they can actually accept those funds. The other thing that was in the service agreement, the private agreement between Carroll and ICE, is the fact that ICE will ask the federal government, the DOJ specifically, to represent Carroll if Carroll is sued by anyone who's challenging their immigration status or their detainment. So in this private agreement, we can see that there's a little bit more of a commitment by ICE to offer legal services to Carroll should that be necessary.
You found in your reporting, Sammy, that these agreements with ICE also have guidelines on confidentiality and the public's access to government records. And as you said, we're just starting to get some information here. Tell us more about what those are and how you're seeing that in your reporting.
That was a really unexpected finding, I would say, in the reporting. Obviously, the departments that have partnered with ICE through this 287G model are public. There's an Excel sheet that ICE updates almost every day, and you can go to that and click on a link and see the terms of the MOA, the Memorandum of Agreement between ICE and this local department. Separate from that, what I found in filing requests specifically with Carroll to get their town records is that to actually accept the money from the federal government, they had to reach a service agreement. And that service agreement had, as you've said, these kind of different terms about confidentiality. So one of the terms was that this agreement and information obtained under this agreement, at least it purports to say, is subject not to the state records law, seemingly, but to federal records law, that I, as a member of the media or a citizen of New Hampshire, if I'm filing a request to try to get back records about that agreement, I would have to file it under federal law and not under state law, which is not something that I've seen before or had seen reported before. There's also specific agreements about if a member of Congress reaches out to Carroll, Carroll would have to forward that request to the Office of Congressional Relations at ICE and wouldn't be able to answer it directly. There's questions about if they can release statements to the media or if they have to clear those statements with ICE's Office of Public Affairs. But basically, they've kind of added in various provisions that govern the release of information, but they've added that in a service agreement that's purportedly about the exchanging of funds or essentially the federal government paying Carroll. So it's kind of this new way to introduce a separate set of contractual obligations in this separate document that we didn't already know about.
Sammy Sussman is an investigative reporter. You can find his story on Carroll's work with ICE at wired.com. Sammy, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Now, we're about halfway through New Hampshire's current legislative session. Thursday was crossover day, with both the House and Senate holding floor sessions for final votes on bills originating in their chambers. Now, joining me now for a legislative roundup is Anna Brown. She's the executive director of Citizens Count and of the Rudman Center at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. Morning, Anna.
Great to be here.
Great to have you back. First, what are some of the most important issues arising out of this session so far?
The number one issue is school funding. For sure. So we have bills that are pushing back on the New Hampshire Supreme Court's school funding rulings that came out this past summer. There's a bill looking to do open enrollment in all public schools. Another hugely important issue, would I say, just gender broad brush there. So, for example, there are many bills that are looking to allow gender or sex-based discrimination in some settings like sports, bathrooms, and so on. And then the income tax debate, I would say, is another one that's making its way around, and not only at the state level, but also, how are we doing taxation at the local level? And so there's some bills looking to require certain vote thresholds to change local taxes or requiring a vote at every general election on capping school district spending.
So a lot of these issues seem perennial. They go around and around.
Yes.
We talk about these all the time. What bills have you been most interested in following?
This year, I've been really interested in bills where it seems like there's disagreement between the House, the Senate, and the governor, because we have Republicans controlling all three of those places, but they really operate differently. So a perfect example of one I'm going to be watching going forward is the Charlie Act, and that was named for Charlie Kirk, but it stands for Countering Hate and Revolutionary Leftist Indoctrination in Education Act. Bit of a mouthful. It's a broad sweeping bill that's looking to limit teaching about critical race theory. If you're going to talk about certain concepts related to socialism or communism, you have to say that, this is contrary to the foundation of the United States. It says that you can't discuss, homosexuality or transgender individuals as sort of normative or okay. So really, really broad sweeping. Huge priority for some of the House leaders, such as Jason Osborne. However, we've seen a different reception in the Senate, and a representative from the governor's office, the attorney general, I should say, the executive branch, someone from the executive branch came in and said, this is really broad sweeping and we have some legal concerns here. So I think it might not fare so well in the Senate. So that's an example where the House and the Senate kind of They're in different modes. I'd say the Senate is a little more, we'll hold back. We're going to do less sweeping legislation, where the House is hard charging and a lot of those hotter issue bills.
Well, and that's traditional, isn't it? I mean, we often see that in the House and then the Senate kind of cooling off some of these bills. What has the governor been saying about some of these bills that have been bantered and going back and forth between the chambers?
She has definitely weighed in some ways that I think are surprising and going to shape legislation. So first of all, she's already vetoed a few of the bills that are looking to add those carve-outs for a separation based on, quote-unquote, biological sex, however that's defined in the bills, bathroom, sports, and so on. So she vetoed one last year. She's vetoed them this year. That continues to be an issue. She's also come in and vetoed a bipartisan bill that was looking to set up a fee-based program for recycling paint. And then just this week in the House, we saw another bill that's a similar concept about recycling batteries. And so I'm sort of waiting to see how that plays out. Meanwhile, the Senate passed a bill to increase tolls for people who do not have a New Hampshire Easy Pass responder. And this is, okay, we got to fund our roads. And so tolls and gas tax are not linked to inflation. We all know costs have gone up a lot since gas tax was last raised in 2014. So the Senate said, all right, let's increase tolls for people outside New Hampshire. Governor Ayotte has said this is dead on arrival. So I don't know how that's going to play out in the House. I can't imagine they're going to like it very much since they're already kind of leery in taxes and fees. Mm-hmm. But just because we have Republicans in the House, Senate, and governor's office, they are not always on the same page.
That's true. And the word tax is obviously,
Hot button issue.
Always a hot button word in the State House. Any bills that you haven't seen in it that a lot of coverage about that you feel are really important to highlight?
So I don't know if they are pivotally important, but I am very interested to follow them. And the first one is SB 640, and this is looking to limit the use of AI in mental health practice. And it was amended in the Senate, and it's basically saying you have to have a licensed professional involved. But there were some opponents, and we all have heard the horror stories, right, about, you know, someone is using ChatGPT and it tells them how to tie a noose. Horrifying stuff. Mm-hmm. But there were some opponents in the state Senate in the public hearing who were saying, this is an emerging area of technology. We have a mental health wait list. What can we do with this? So the idea is, all right, so long as you have to have the licensed professional involved, there's some guardrails there. But I'm already seeing some posts on social media. Again, you know, that's where legislators often like to start their debates.
Yep.
And are saying, particularly libertarians, are saying, we want to fight this, that this is stifling innovation. And also, is this opening the door to the state really wanting to limit what AI can do, because it's not like they can't regulate AI the same way they can a licensed professional. And the Office of Professional Licensure and Certification did testify on this bill in the Senate and say, this is something we're interested in. We do want to have some control over these different licensed areas that AI could be stepping into. And we want to be clear, we should be able to regulate that. So this is the bill of the future, I think.
I think so. We'll be watching for that, and we're watching more and have you in again to talk more about that, I think, and many, many other things. Anna Brown, Executive Director of Citizens Count and of the Rudman Center at the UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. Anna, thanks so much. It's great to see you again.
Happy Friday, Rick.
You can find more of our politics coverage at nhpr.org. I'm Rick Gamble, and this is NHPR.